Oh, hello, people in podcast land. Welcome back. My guest today is none other than Jay Morton, former SAS operator and two-time Everest summitee. Got him on today to talk about his new book, Soldier. Becoming a soldier means dealing with fear, coping with pressure, and performing with excellence. The SAS is the best of the best. And today, we learn the key lessons from Jay's 14-year career. So expect to learn how humor can help with fear, whether climbing Everest is harder than the SAS selection process, the coolest operation Jay was a part of, how to take advantage of opportunity like a soldier, and much more. All right, quick maths. The less that your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have, the more money that you keep. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce the costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite, and you are improving efficiency by bringing all your business processes into one platform. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move, so do the maths and see how you will profit with NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/modern right now. That's netsuite.com/modern. This episode is brought to you by Crafted London. Finding men's jewelry that doesn't suck is very difficult, and Crafted London have nailed it. They're the number one men's jewelry company worldwide. They're sweatproof, waterproof, heatproof, and gymproof. They've got custom designs in gold and silver, necklaces, chains, pendants, bracelets, rings, and earrings. If you've seen me on any of the big cinema episodes on YouTube wearing a necklace, it will always be from Crafted. I absolutely love it. It works with formal wear, casual wear, whether it's daytime or nighttime. All of their pieces are super high quality. The designs are great, and I love them. It's all I wear. Also, they have an unlimited lifetime guarantee, so if your piece breaks for any reason at any point during the entire life of the product, they will give you a new one for free. Get a 15% discount site-wide on everything by going to bit.ly/cdwisdom and using the code MW15 at checkout. That's bit.ly/letter C letter D wisdom and MW15 at checkout. This episode is brought to you by Whoop. I have worn Whoop for over 4 years now, since way before they were a partner on the show, and it is the only wearable I have ever stuck with because it's the best. It is so innocuous, you do not remember that you've got it on, and yet it tracks absolutely everything 24/7 via something from your wrist. It tracks your heart rate, it tracks your sleep, your recovery, all of your workouts, your resting heart rate, your heart rate variability, how much you're breathing throughout the night. It puts all of this into an app and spits out very simple, easy to understand, and fantastically usable data. It's phenomenal. I am a massive, massive fan of Whoop, and that is why it's the only wearable that I've ever stuck with. You can join for free. Pay nothing for the brand new Whoop 4.0 strap. Plus, you get your first month for free, and there's a 30-day money-back guarantee. So you can buy it for free, try it for free, and if you do not like it, after 29 days, they will give you your money back. Head to join.whoop.com/modernwisdom. That's join.whoop.com/modernwisdom. But for now, it's time for the wise and wonderful Jay Morton. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. I'm joined by Jay Morton. Jay, welcome to the show.
How's it going, Chris? You good?
Very well. I'm in Dubai. How could I not be well? I do need to hold my hands up for everyone that is watching on YouTube. Yes, I'm wearing a vest. Yes, I caught a little bit of sun today. Tiny little bit, just a bit flush, right? But I haven't seen sunshine for like 6 months. So give me a break. I've also got you currently, Jay. You're balanced on an upturned bin in my hotel room, and I'm doing this after tethering to my phone on roaming data. So God knows how much this is going to cost, but it's more than worth it. So thank you very much for coming on, man.
Too easy. Yeah, you never see what's in the background, do you, of what you've got?
I've done
it the same, where you've just got to balance your phone and whatever's going on in the background. So
absolute chaos, mate. It's just a
And you're a northerner too. You're a fellow northerner, so don't do well in the sun.
Look, I've got two ginger parents, but thankfully I don't think I've fully inherited their skin. But you're totally right, man. When you're from Winterfell, you don't tan. Don't tan
exactly.
Well.
You go white. You just seem to go white.
Yeah. That leads me quite nicely into talking about the temperature, leads me quite nicely into something I wanted to ask, which is more difficult, the selection process for Special Forces or climbing Everest twice?
I'd have to say climbing Everest. Selection, you know, 6 month SAS selection just seems to... It's drawn out over 6 months, right? And when you start, you're already a seasoned soldier. Like for me, I've done one tour of Iraq and two tours of Afghanistan. So you almost get to that stage where you want to prove yourself as a soldier. And I was, you know, 24 years old, like full of testosterone. So like you go on selection with a bunch of other lads and you're all, you know, you've got this unified kind of cause that you're all going for at the same time. And I actually enjoyed selection for that reason. Cause you meet, you know, you end up all, you know, you start with maybe 150, 170 people. After the first 3 weeks, you're kind of down to 50. And then after the next 6 weeks, you're kind of down to maybe 20, 25 people. And these 20, 25 people have been through absolute shit. So you end up forming this like super tight bond where you're all really close and all really clicky. And then you get to the end of selection after that 6 months, you get given your stable belt and your beret and you get like a picture took next to the clock tower. You shake everyone's hand and then you disappear into whatever regiment and squadrons that you go to. And then the next day, you kind of big boys rules into the mix,
thrown into the lion's den.
Yeah, and I remember turning up day one, and like I was 24, like it's quite a young age to pass selection, and like the rest of the guys in my troop were all kind of, I mean, some of them were touching 40 years old. So as a 24-year-old turning up into this SAS troop with a load of 40-year-olds. Even like the guy who came in 2 years before me, he was like, you know, 2-3 years ahead of me. And like, they're all like big guys, like big kind of men with like gray hair and stuff. And
yeah, big hands, massive hands.
Like, you know, we had, Billy was one of our senior sergeants at the time. And, you know, he was like, ex kind of football hooligan from London and just covered in like skull tattoos and like flames up his arm and stuff.
Very welcoming.
Turns like, yeah, we actually went to Norway on our first exercise and I ended up spending the whole 6 weeks living in a tent with him. So we got on quite well.
Very cozy after a while, yeah.
Yeah, as it turns out, he was the nicest guy there.
That's awesome, man. Yeah, and how does that relate to Everest then?
Yeah, so like Everest is like quite a big, it's a big misconception for some people, because a lot of people think that because of the amount of people that go up and the caliber of people that go up, it's an easy thing to do. And coming from someone who's done a lot of difficult things in their life, Everest is by no means an easy feat. It just seems to attract people who can afford it because it comes with a very high price tag. Mm. So it kind of attracts a certain caliber of people. Mm. And you do end up with a lot of dross on the mountain, which doesn't give it a very good reputation. But Everest is more, it's 6 weeks of living at altitude. So if you think like altitude just basically takes away energy from you. So if you stand up and walk 10 meters at sea level, it's fine, right? You don't think about it. But if you're at, you know, 6,000-7,000 meters in the sky and you stand up and walk 10 meters, you know, you're taking a couple of steps, stopping, breathing, taking a couple of steps, stopping, breathing. So like everything that you deemed easy at sea level is magnified in difficulty the further up you go, to the point of on your summit push, when, you know, if you think of your summit push, it's quite, just to give a picture of kind of the severity of it, you do like an you get up to base camp, you do an acclimatization, which takes 5 days or 6 days. You come back down, you rest at base camp, which is at 5,600 meters. And then you kind of sit there and look at the weather windows. And you always get one weather window to summit, which is clear skies, you know, minimal winds. You sometimes get two weather windows, and you rarely get three. So it's this balance of, you know, all your weather systems and speaking to like people around the camps and finding out what's going on. Because like you've invested all this time, right? You've invested like the last 3 weeks of living at altitude, eating shit food, you know, shitting into a hole in the ground every morning.
A frozen hole in the ground.
It's like clockwork every morning, and you know your only entertainment is the game of cards that you play at night in the tent. And by this time, you're sick of lunch and meat and rice. So you invested all this energy and time into making the right decision and getting to the, you know, getting high up and summiting in the right weather window. Because if you don't, that's it. You know, you only get one shot at summiting. And you kind of set off at camp three on your summit push. So you'll leave camp three, which is 7,000 meters. And there's four camps till summit. So you go camp three, 7,000 meters, leave there at 5 a.m. on oxygen. You climb up to camp four, arrive at camp four, say 4 p.m. So that's a full day to get there. Camp four is 8,000 meters. So you rest there in a tent for, you know, 6 hours. You try and get some sleep. You get some hot water on. You cook some food. And then you leave that night at 8 p.m. to summit for first light. So, you know, 6 a.m., 7 a.m. in the morning. And then you've got all that day to come all the way back down to camp two, which you get to camp two at, say, like I got there about 9 p.m. So
it's a 15-hour day at ridiculous altitude.
Yeah. So you start 5 a.m. It's like 2 days, basically, just constantly with no sleep, minimal water. At that altitude, your body doesn't work the same, so you don't digest food. So I was literally living off like the little energy sachets that like cyclists and triathletes and that use, which obviously then, you know, I ended up with that just all over my hands, just like sticky, and it just leaks out into your pocket. So every time you put your hand in your pocket, your hand gets stuck. You're not drinking as much water just because you're constantly needing to move. And kind of beyond camp four up to the summit, your body's kind of that drained and tired and exhausted. It's simply just that one foot in front of the other, that slow kind of monotonous like tap, tap, tap. And then you just see everyone doing it. Everyone kind of puts their arm, like their elbows on the legs in like, because you're on like a steep hill, and just gives it like a few couple of puffs of breath and just composes themselves before they set off again. And then you get to the top, and then coming down is even worse because it's steep ground. And then you've got this mass of people that are coming down at the same time. So, you know, you're trying to work your way through all these people for like the next 17. So you summit at 6 a.m. I'm no good at math. Summit at 6 a.m., get back down for 10 p.m. So what's that? 16, 14 hours of walking downhill where your toes are just hitting the front of your boots for 14 hours to the point you start walking sideways and then you change to the other side and then you start walking backwards. Yeah. You just like I've been exhausted and tired and like fatigued and so many times in like my military career, but like you're never that fatigued and exhausted that you are on Everest.
It seems like a big part of that is the camaraderie that you had and the support structure from when you were doing special forces selection. I guess as well, like if you're in thin air and it's really cold and you're on a thin ridge, it's like, first off, you're spread out. Second, you've got to save your breath to be able to focus on the few bodily functions that your physiology is still able to do. Whereas, as you said, during your special forces, you're really able, you've got this sort of unity that binds you all together and makes maybe the suffering a little bit less solo.
Yeah, a little bit. I think you know, for a start, you're at sea level, so that makes things way easier. I guess when you're at sea level and you're doing the things that you're doing in the special forces, you always know where the end is, and the end's usually quite comfortable. So say you're deploying an operation that is anything from, you know, 10 hours, 12 hours on a night raid, or you go out for a week and live in a building and put an OP in or whatever it is. And you always know at the end of that, you take enough food, you take enough water, you know, you're warm, you've taken enough, sleeping equipment or enough jackets and warm clothing that you're going to be semi-comfortable, right? There might be a little bit of hardship. You might be walking in with some weight and some kit. You do the job, you extract or whatever it is. But you know, at the end of that week, unless the job or mission changes, you're going to come back to base or wherever it is that you live, whether you're in the UK, you come back, you're probably, you know, having beers with the boys at the weekend or whatever. Or if you're overseas, you know, you're coming back to a camp, you're de-kitting, you're going for steak and eggs in the morning, you're going to get back in the gym. Whereas like on Everest, it's like you set off on that summit window and that rotation on that summit window is 7 days. So you leave base camp. you leave base camp with a rucksack and you come back in 7 days with that same rucksack. And you're not coming back to steak and eggs and beers with the boys and a warm shower. You come back to a hot water, you know, hot bucket of water and a little bit of leftover like shampoo that you took into
a slightly bigger hole in the ground to have a poop in.
Yeah. Well, everyone's just been like filling it in whilst you've been gone. So it's like overflowing.
No. Please make it stop.
It's not like that hotel room in Dubai, I tell you.
It is lovely out here. So we're talking about your new book today, which will be out when this episode is live. What does respect is earned mean?
So kind of the book is just, you know, it's to just say like, this is my 14 years of military experience in the special forces and the paras. And I've just put all that knowledge and experience into the book. And it's essentially that, right? It's read this book and respect is earned. It's like, do the hard stuff through my military career. And it's like, that is how you gain respect.
I understand. Let's go through the four tenets of the special forces. I thought this was really interesting.
Yeah. So you've got relentless pursuit for excellence. So that is, you know, if you think of like values that you live your life by, the special forces has those. And first one's relentless pursuit of excellence. And, you know, it should be something that we should be searching for every day within the special forces, whether it's whatever we're doing, whether it's shooting, we're always trying to get better at shooting, whether it's, you know, surveillance, OPs, whatever it is that we're doing, we need to always be searching for that level of excellence. And like, obviously you never get to that level, you know, you never get to that level that is excellence, but that constant progression of just keep chipping away at whatever it is you're doing, whether it's in the gym, whether it's at home, whether it's whatever it is, to just be a better human being and better in the job that you're doing. And that's kind of the first one. The second one is honor and humility. So kind of humility is a massive one in the special forces. You know, it's, I mean, even like I remember bumping into a load of SBS lads when I was in the paras, and the first thing that came across was, you know, you had these guys, they were men, they were like 40 odd years old, like big dudes and that, but they were like the soundest guys ever. And they came and found us, looked after us, and we played volleyball and they bought us a load of beers. And you know, just that, it doesn't matter what you do in your career and where you've been, it's like you still have that humble approach, which will keep you hungry and will keep you always wanting to improve. And then honor is, you know, as it says, it's having honor in what you do and honor of the people that you work with and honor of the job that you're doing. And then discipline goes without saying. It is, you know, it's one of the most important things that a soldier needs to have is discipline. You know, it's no hidden secret that, you know, soldiers are people that or if you're on a job or on a task, you're getting up early, you're doing things that aren't necessarily comfortable things to do, or aren't very natural things to do. And that requires a lot of discipline, a lot of self-discipline, to be, you know, to be that best cohesive team unit that you can be. And I've had a mind slip. What's the fourth one?
I haven't got them written down, mate. So we can leave it at three. We can leave it at three.
I'm trying to think. What is the fourth one? What is the fourth one? There is. Yeah, we'll leave it at three.
Three it is now.
We can come back to it.
The fourth one's obviously not that important.
They've changed it.
Yeah, this is the Jay Morton version of the four tenets.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I didn't realize that the SAS was split up into four squadrons with four troops within each. Can you just take us through how this works and the personalities that you explain about that?
Yeah, so you've got kind of different teams within any special forces unit, and then those teams are broken down into individual skill sets, and kind of the skill sets are air, so anything that is in the air, so helicopters, mainly kind of parachuting and being a subject matter expert in parachuting, boats, anything that's to do with water, and then you've got mobility, which is land vehicles, so motorbikes, quads, off-road vehicles, 4x4s, all that kind of stuff. And then you've got mountain, which is what I was, which is anything to do with the mountains. So above the snow line, so you've got kind of Arctic warfare and, you know, stuff in kind of, you know, the Scandinavian countries, that kind of stuff. And then that kind of filters over into kind of a more like a rope work kind of, like a rope access kind of thing, to try and not put too much detail on it, if that makes sense. To try and keep it as bland as possible as that sits.
I understand. What's the coolest operation that you can tell us about?
Do you know, like, I don't know, like, coolest is probably like not the word I'd use, but like there's a few that really stick out, and a few things that I kind of ticked off whilst I was serving that, again, I can't talk about. But there was one job on an IED factory. It was a daytime raid on an IED is an improvised explosive device. So it's like a homemade bomb that the enemy would use against us. So it could be anything. So it would be anything that is homemade, and they'd, you know, the main way of using it would be sticking it in the ground, covering it with dirt. You walk over it, it blows up. And we hit a factory that was making these on a mass scale. I kind of don't want to go too much into the detail, like, Chris, because it's
I understand.
We basically had
operational secrecy.
We basically had nine guys on it, and it was anything. It almost reminded me of like a crazy Western movie, when we kind of landed the helicopters next to the compound, and I was with a team of Afghans, and we come running off the back of this helicopter, and a few of the guys from the factory just like legged it from the factory, and they took their chances and just like ran, and I was like first man out. There was only like, I think there was only a few of us British, and these Afghans just started firing over my head, and I could feel like bullets just whizzing past me. I literally turned around and just said, stop firing. I'm going to shoot one of us. it was like a crazy Western film. But no, that was, do you know what? That sticks out as one of the best jobs I did, probably because the impact it had on the local area in terms of, you know, the IED, the numbers of IEDs that were hitting British troops that were operating in the area went substantially down. And we got, you know, nine of the guys that were making these IEDs at the same time. So that for me sticks out massively. There's a few others that I won't go into too much detail about.
I understand. The MOD wouldn't be happy, but that it's so cool to see where when the special forces are deployed to cut off at the knees an operation which obviously down the line will be hurting local Afghans. It will be meant to attack other British forces and other foreign sort of forces that are out there. So yeah, I can totally see why that would be something that you'd be proud of. Another one, again, this might be an MOD dance around. When were you the most scared during your service? Is there anything that comes to mind which you can tell us about?
Probably when those bullets are flying past me.
That's perfect.
Fear is like one of those weird things when you're operating in that kind of environment. And it can come and go at like the most randomest of times, and you generally, you know, you go overseas for 6 months at a time, and you know, after a while you change how you deal with things in your own head. You find like ways of just coping with whatever's going on. And I don't mean that in a negative way. If anything, it's a positive way. But you kind of just like fear doesn't really appear as much as, I don't know, you could go through like a, cause like soldiers are really good at coping with fear with humor. And a lot of some of the scariest moments that I would say are the scariest moments, right? If you took a normal person and threw them in that situation, like you seem to cope very well with it with a lot of humor. And yeah, I can remember kind of a few times when, and this was going back to kind of my days in the parachute regiment in 3PARA. And, you know, I remember one day when we just got opened up on and, you know, you're seeing like rounds hitting like walls and the floor around where you are. And, you know, whether it's, you know, the Taliban didn't have their weapon zero that day, or, you know, something else was looking after you, you know, you don't end up with a bullet in you, but you're so close to it. And there's, you know, there's a few situations like that. But again, it's like, you know, we just got, you know, when that happened and we got opened up on in you know, point blank range, we literally just ran around this corner and just all started laughing at each other. I don't know. It's like whether there's a lesson there that, you know, the best way of just dealing with fear is just with humor. And it's like, you know, it's like one of those reactions, right? Of something happens and like people instantly smile, and it's like you know, if you look at that situation, you probably shouldn't be smiling, but you do. You just seem to laugh about it.
I know. I wonder what it is. I wonder whether fear and humor are somewhere along the same sort of line. But there's a bit of an archetype there, right? You know, the crazy soldier who is able to laugh off, but it was a scratch. You know, like that kind of like classic stiff upper lip British thing.
Yeah, like I've seen lads get shot and they're just laughing and smiling and probably happier than they would be if they hadn't have been shot.
What?
Like not on impact, right? And I might have, you know, because like everything happens quite fast in fight and combat, right? Mm. You generally, you know, if you think how fast a round flies, and as soon as that goes out the gun, it's straight into someone's body. And that's a very quick situation to happen. So then you don't have time for fear to evolve. So you're thinking like, fuck, right, I'm going to grab this guy, drag him into some cover, sort him out, administer first aid, and then we need to extract him back to a point where he can be picked up and taken to safety and be seen by like a proper medical professional. So like there's no time there for fear to overcome, if that makes sense. Mm. So yeah, it's like, but yeah, I've seen kind of, you know, even guys that have lost limbs, and I don't mean on impact that it's happened, but you know, you've got to be able to deal with it with humor. And I actually remember one incident, and I won't go into too much detail about it, but one of the guys ended up getting a shotgun through his knee by accident, and like ruined him, like probably, you know, made a mess of this guy's career. And I remember everyone just started taking the piss out of him. The guy that that accidentally discharged the shotgun into this guy's knee. And I remember chatting to him. I think we were in a car driving to London or something. And I was chatting to him and he was like, I was like, you know, how do you feel about it? Whatever. And he's like, the best thing that happened was that people took the piss out of him. He was like, if no one took the piss out of me, then I would have felt that I've done something seriously wrong. But because everyone's just took the piss out of me and like made jokes and sent out, you know, memes and pictures on WhatsApp groups, like I just feel like better about the whole situation.
There's examples similar to that I had with Seth Godin. So I was recording with him a couple of weeks ago, and similar to today with you, just having a nightmare with connections. He needed to change his and I needed to change mine, and we're on a really tight time schedule as well. And he made such a classy move when we came back on. So after all of the connections had gone out and then we logged back onto the call and we were about to get going, when we first called him, before he even said, hello, is everything sorted or anything, he just told me a joke. Like a really shit dad joke, like awful, awful, like totally terrible. But any tension between me and a 20 times best-selling author and marketing Hall of Fame member, yeah, Seth Godin, this absolute titan of internet fame, was gone in a second. So I definitely think that there's an interesting lesson to take away from that, like the use that humor has for all of us, especially to dissuade pressure and tension and fear, you know, before someone's about to go on stage to give a good speech, a big speech, or before you're about to go and do a pitch or a job interview or perform or, you know, do anything. I think that there's definitely an argument to be made that if you've got a couple of shit jokes in your pocket that you can just deploy on demand, I reckon that they would be really useful.
But it's so true, right? And it, you know, they do say that like, the cleverest people have the highest IQs. The funniest people. There's a correlation between like clever people and
funny people. Absolutely.
That's why I'm not there. But but yeah, there is. There's definitely, because like we're all the same person, right? We all eat. We all shit. We all do all that stuff. And you get, I don't know, you build that perception. It's like you might have had with Seth. You put people like that on a pedestal, and it's like we're all just the same person, and you know, we can all tell a shit dad joke.
my dad absolutely can. Okay, so the book's called Soldier, and that's an acronym for a bunch of things that go underneath it. The first one being self, and you call discipline the first effective habit. Have you got any tips on how people can cultivate their discipline? Obviously, we're in the middle, in the UK at least, of a brand new lockdown, and people may be thinking this is a time where I can either let my habits go one of two ways. What can people do to cultivate that discipline?
Yeah, like it's quite important now, right, during the second lockdown phase that, like, I had this thought during the first lockdown phase that, like, I'm not going to let this time just waste away and slip out under me and you know, all I can say that I've done during lockdown was watch some Netflix documentaries and box sets and that's it. And it's like important that people just focus on like what's important to them, and you know, just without digressing too far off that discipline thing. I just said like last lockdown, I want to improve my fitness, my education, and my family, and like, fitness is pretty simple, right? You know, you do whatever exercise routine, you go for a run, you pick up something that you're going to get better at. Education, it was like, right, I'm going to learn some new stuff. I started trying to play the guitar, started listening to more podcasts, audiobooks, started reading, started researching stuff that I'm interested in. And then family was like, right, speak to my family more often, make sure that they're safe, speak to a friend at least once a day, like chat to people that, because you get off that conversation, you feel better. You feel better than you did when you went on. But yeah, like discipline. Going back to discipline, it's, you know, like I think I always say, it's like your choice to be more disciplined. And you can read books and you can listen to podcasts and stuff for motivation. But essentially, you've got to make the choice that you want more discipline in your life. And once you've made that choice, then you've just got to implement things in that give you discipline. And that might just be, you know, just setting an alarm clock. You know, if you're off work at the minute and you just don't set an alarm clock and you wake up at 9 o'clock, just set that alarm clock for 7 or 8 or whatever it is and just get up with an alarm clock every day. And then try and make that alarm clock earlier. Like at the minute, I'm trying to get up at 6:30 because it's starting to get light, and just start doing stuff like go out for a walk and just commit to going out for a walk. And then, you know, commit to an exercise regime, commit to reading one book every month. Just start like trying to set yourself these small tasks. I read in a book once, and this guy was trying to talk about discipline, and he said, you know, one thing he said, just if you put a plate in the sink, every time you put a plate in the sink or anything, wash it and just don't leave it there. And it's like these little like hacks or tricks or tips that you do every day build discipline into your life. And that those small ones then flow into the bigger ones that you need discipline for, whether it's training for a marathon, whether it's researching for a job interview or whatever it is, these little ones feed into it.
Yeah. How you do anything is how you do everything.
And I love that saying, Chris.
One of the things that I used as a little tip for people, and it's timely for me to remind everyone who's listening of it again, the best heuristic I found to make sure that you stay on track during lockdown by having a plan is to ask yourself now, what would have had to have happened by the end of lockdown for me to look back on lockdown and consider it a success? Just after this podcast finishes, like just take a little bit of time and think about it, or do it as me and Jay continue to chat shit to each other. Just think, like, what would have had to have happened by the end of this period for you to look back on it and it be a success? So for me, I have a target for the podcast. I want to hit 100,000 subs on YouTube before Christmas. If I do that, and if everything else continues to tick over, I'll be happy. That's one thing. Last time it was like, I wanted to build a website and start a newsletter and record 3 times a week. Like that was it. Mm-hmm. And it's easy for us to get caught up believing that we should do more, could have done more. When you don't have a tightly defined target, it always feels like you've missed, because you're always going to feel like you could have done more, woulda, shoulda, coulda. And like I say, that's my best question for everyone who's listening, who's thinking about that. So next up is opportunity, and you lay out a 3-stage process for opportunities. Would you be able to take us through that?
Yeah. So the 3-stage process is encounter, recognize, and exploit. So encounter is all about putting yourself in that position where you can encounter those opportunities. So that's like how you've got your life set up, right? For me, you know, the biggest one was going into the military, because I put myself in a position where I could experience other things and other experiences. And that, you know, that put me in a position to be around people that had gone on selection and been in the special forces. And that's when that, you know, although you volunteer for it, it's an opportunity. You know, and then the second one is recognized. So, you know, if I think of something in my life, so the Everest expeditions, right, they came from one, you know, encountering that opportunity, two, recognizing what that opportunity was. And at the time, it was supposed to be an expedition to K2. And, you know, I'm massive on gut feel. If something feels good and it feels like it's going to change my life for the better, then I take that opportunity. But you have to almost, it's like a muscle, right? The more of these opportunities you take and they lead you down these like crazy and different paths, the more you're able to recognize them when they fall on, you know, on your doorstep. And then it's exploiting them, which is, you know, exactly what it is. It's right, where can I take this opportunity? Because we all know that when we take opportunities, or when we agree to things or whatever it is, they always open more doors further down the line. And then those doors open more doors down the line. And before you know it, you know, you've met some other people, you've done some other stuff in your life, and you've gone down a completely different path than what you set out to do.
That's one of the things that I've been thinking about recently. Obviously, this little trip that I've taken out to Dubai, I decided the Sunday after the Saturday that lockdown was announced, got a PCR test on the Monday for COVID, packed on the Tuesday and left on the Wednesday. I'm not always like a perfect bastion of immediate action, I suppose. You know, we get stuck in, everyone gets stuck in ruts, and I'm no different. But that single decision, the opportunity for me to be able to get away before lockdown came in, and then the single time commitment has had multiple downstream changes. Like, it's literally the difference between me being here with it being like 9 p.m. at night in 30 degree heat off on a yacht party tomorrow on the biggest yacht in Dubai, or me being in the UK and doing the life that I had there. And I love the life that I have in the UK, and it's very productive, but I've done it all this year. So yes, recognizing opportunities, and I think committing to them, that the exploit part is really important. A lot of people will see something and not realize that it is an opportunity, or not decide to commit to it. And it's trite to say it, but it's very true that we often, I would say that more of our regrets certainly lean toward things that we chose not to do rather than things that we chose to do. We as creatures err on the side of stagnation. I think naturally,
yeah, 100%.
Our tendency is to the status quo. I'm scared about that new cave next door. I'm scared about that new bush over there. I'm scared about that new tribe in the next valley. And you just roll that forward to the 21st century when we really don't have anything to be afraid of, like COVID and like mad political elections and stuff like that. But really, day to day, your safety, the water, the heat of being somewhere sheltered, all that sort of stuff, all of those fears have gone, and they've become that worry around new experiences has been transmuted into people being concerned about all manner of small things that really don't matter. You know, think about like anyone's slightly anxious mum. It's like that person, like, oh, have you got your coat on? Have you got your gloves on? Have you got, the, you know, that kind of approach, I think, is just a maladapted evolutionary heritage coming through.
Yeah, but like, you know, that's like a lot of people, right, in the world. And it's, you know, that whole like wrapping people up in cotton wool and, you know, even just, you know, we all live, like you said, right, we all live in these buildings, these four walls. Like, we don't know what it feels like to feel rain on our face at nighttime or be cold. Like, we're rarely cold as human beings, right? Like, we rarely have to walk long distances or fend for our own food. And you know, it's like it all creates a softer human being. And it's almost like what you're seeing now as a result is people get so offended because they've got almost this free time to become offended by things. Whereas, you know, like if you had to fend for your food and get all this kind of stuff, it's like you wouldn't have that time available to be able to do that kind of stuff.
Massively so, man. I realized this at the beginning of the first lockdown when COVID came about. In the absence of a real crisis, we create our own. And in the presence of a real crisis, we recenter our priorities. The fact that when everything's so comfortable and all of our problems are problems of surplus, not problems of scarcity at the moment. So think about the fact that we have too much information, too much food, too much spare time even to concern ourselves with this stuff. And all of those problems are now causing stuff, diabetes, people being overweight, technology addiction, so on and so forth. And yeah, we're maladapted to the environment, and it's increasingly why you see people going back to a more Paleolithic style of life. You know, people that choose the minimalist movement now is a 21st century hark back to people trying to reduce the amount of clutter that's in their lives, trying to reduce that amount of surplus. So yeah, it's
well, you've only got to look at like the amount of people that are entering Ironmans and ultra triathlons and that kind of stuff these days, because like the human body needs suffering. Like it needs some kind of suffering, because we've had it all our life, right? And you take all that suffering away and make an easy life for yourself, and you know, everything's at the touch of a button and everything's so easily accessible. It's not. You know, that's why you see like depression and suicide at such a high rate, because people just don't know how to suffer anymore.
That's an interesting That's an interesting insight on it. I think that you're probably correct there, that voluntary exposure to gradually increasing levels of discomfort will make you more tolerant to it over time. There's a really interesting study that they did on children, babies, infants. So I think that if you are a child who has, I want to say eczema, or some other skin condition, you are also predisposed to having peanut allergy. I think that it's one of the highlights, right? So what they did was they took children who had the eczema particular problem and voluntarily split them into two different groups. Group one was allowed to have rice puffs that had a very, very slight peanut coating dusting on them. And the other group was kept free of nuts. The argument is that most parents that learn about eczema would hear that if your child has eczema, there is a increased risk of them being allergic to peanuts. Therefore, they will keep them away from absolutely everything that may have nuts in it. And what they did was they tracked these children over time. And the end result of the study was that the children who had been voluntarily exposed to the peanuts had a 25% peanut allergy. The children who had been kept free of all of the peanut dust had a 75% peanut allergy.
Yeah, it's wacky.
It's crazy, man.
It's crazy.
Voluntarily exposing yourself to things that are going to be difficult. Like, why are people doing cold showers at the moment? It's the ultimate doing something just because it hurts. There's some physiological adaptations which are good, and you get a bit of a buzz off it. It's like having a big fat cup of coffee that lasts for about 20 minutes, which is nice. But for the most part, it's people avoiding that flinch. You know, like, why are you scared of getting in the cold shower? Like, really, why are you scared? And it's a very interesting internal battle to watch yourself go through. Because you know it's going to be cold, but it's not going to kill you. It's not even going to hurt you. It's just going to be a little bit uncomfortable. So yeah, I think that's definitely something that I would try and encourage in as many people as I can. So we've got the word soldier, self, opportunity, leadership, danger, intelligence, excellence, and resilience. Out of the ones that we got left, which one's your favorite? Can we go into that one?
So I think I would say caught me off guard. do you know what? Like, I'd say probably my favorite self. More so because I can get quite deep on myself, and I'm quite interested by human psychology and how we all fit into the world, and like being able to pull out your true potential and understand where like people fit into teams and that we're not all different. And in the book, I talk about personality testing, in specific the Myers-Briggs personality testing, and you know, it's something that everyone should go and do just to find out what their personality type is. Because I think a lot of people just float through the universe, just not diving deep on what kind of person they actually are. So when you actually do a test and get a result, it gives you a more realization of what you're actually like.
Yeah, I think it's quite uncomfortable for a lot of people to do self-reflection, especially if you're not used to it. And I get that. I would probably guess that a lot of the people who are listening skew towards a very different sort of type of person. They're going to be incredibly introspective. They're going to do a lot of self-inquiry just because of the sort of guests that I have on. But there is no amount of money on the planet that you could pay me to stop thinking about my internal monologue. Like, it's the single most fascinating thing that I do.
Agreed.
I love working out motivations, and I do it in other people as well. And when you get to a particular level of competence with yourself, you're able to help other people, and that feels really, really good. You know, you kind of like you were talking before about voluntary discomfort. So, okay, I'm going to go through a little bit of discomfort thinking about some stuff that happened in my past that I don't like, or thinking about a thing that I really wish that I wish I didn't have, whatever. And after you work through that and you realize that it didn't kill you, you can then help other people around you to do it. It's a beautiful use of time, man. I think that's a good shout.
Yeah, definitely. Like what I really love doing on myself is trying to understand why I make decisions or why I do certain things, and just going like just doing the deep dive and trying to understand like why I'm so hell bent on being like fit and healthy and
a psychopath like, that goes up to the top of Everest twice.
Yeah, like things like that. What is my absolute reason for doing that? And there's probably a load of different reasons, but I quite enjoy having a very objective or pulled out point of view of everything, and just try and even observe other people and just be like, right, like why does so many people sit in front of the TV and listen to the news and listen to the media and like live on its every word as though that's the truth, and just try and have a very abstract point of view on absolutely everything that goes on through myself and through the world.
Yeah, I think the rationalist movement, which is going on at the moment, lesswrong.com and the Slate Star Codex, that I'm a massive fan of, two fantastic blogs. I think that a big part of that is people trying to bring a little bit of order to chaos. Because if you leave your life to be guided by the paths of least resistance, you often end up in a place not only that you don't want to be, but that you didn't even mean to get to. You know, like you can very easily live a life that you regret without even realizing that you're walking down the path. And
not quite easily, yeah.
That's something that everybody should be fearful of. You know, like
we're made to like live this easy life, aren't we? Like you will search out the easiest way of doing things every time, unless you're aware that you're doing those things.
Yeah. So underneath everything, actually, there's a little bit of a source code that people should lean into discomfort wherever they can find it. And the more that you can get used to leaning into it, you know, remember as well, the reason that you go to the gym is for the discomfort. The discomfort is a signal that you're doing the thing you're there to do. Mm-hmm. It's not the thing that you're supposed to, oh, this hurts in the gym, therefore I'll stop doing it. It's like, no. That is why you're there. So people are used to it, right? You know, Arnie used to talk about how much he loved the pump. And in the gym, people are aware that that's why. Okay, I did a thing and the outcome of that thing was a little bit of discomfort, but that's what I'm chasing because it identifies growth.
The body rewards you for that as well, right? Yeah. The body makes you feel good with endorphins.
That just needs mapping onto other areas of life. I had Ali Abdal on not long ago, who's a YouTuber that focuses on learning and productivity. And he nailed it. He was like, learning is supposed to be hard. If it's not difficult, you're not learning.
Yeah.
Exactly the same as the gym. And the same thing goes for everything. So yeah, I definitely think there's a unifying thread across a lot of other stuff. Now, last question for you, man. What is the biggest insight that you wish more people knew about life?
I think we just covered it.
That one, discomfort.
Just search out difficult things and the reward, you'll soon get the reward that it brings you.
I love that. And I agree as well. So Soldier will be linked in the show notes below. If people want to check you out to go and see some other stuff about you, where should they go, Jay?
So mainly Instagram. So it's J_Morton. Also on Twitter and Facebook, but probably less active on those two. And I've got a website as well. It's jmortonofficial.com.
Fantastic. Everything will be linked in the show notes below. What's next for you then, man? Obviously, final thing. You've got this period to sit at home and plan some mad adventures. Oh, well, you're doing some race. What's the race?
So I'm racing for a car team called Praga next year, which is, again, like fairly new to me, the whole motorsport thing. So at the minute, just trying to get as much seat time and as much learning and practice in cars and tracks around the UK as possible. So I'll start. I think my first race is next March.
What's the car? What's the vehicle?
It's called a Praga R1. It's a full aero race car, so you can't buy one and race it on the road. It's strictly a track car, but it's full aero. So, you know, if you think of F1, F1's got an aero system, which means that the faster you drive it, the more it sticks to the ground. So this is the same in this car. The faster you drive it, the more grip you produce. It's got a 350 brake horsepower Renault turbo engine in, and it weighs 600 kg.
Shit the bed.
So yeah, it's a machine. It's like a little single cockpit, like a little single cockpit car. Kind of looks like a smaller Le Mans car.
It's like a rocket ship that's had wheels attached to it.
Exactly. Exactly.
All right, man. Well, look, good luck with that. I hope that you have a very good lockdown, and thank you so much for your time.
Cheers, Chris. Take care.